Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the arguments today before the Supreme Court in Fisher versus University of Texas, which could spell an end to affirmative action. Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, who has argued before the Supreme Court, joins us to discuss whether the conservatives on the court, who seem skeptical of race as a factor in determining college admissions, will strike affirmative action down. Then we will look into the ongoing public health catastrophe from an outbreak of meningitis due to contaminated steroid shots 13,000 people have been exposed to that have caused 12 deaths nationwide. The former Associate Director for Regulatory Affairs at the Office of Human Research Protection within the Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Michael Carome, joins us to explain the loophole allowing manufacturers of this deadly tainted product to escape regulation by the FDA. Then finally, the film critic for The New Yorker, David Denby, joins us to discuss the corporatization of our culture, in particular the movies, where mindless, heartless, and pointless effects-laden event movies tailored for 14-year-old boys have replaced movies and stories and characters that adults used to watch. We will discuss David Denby's new book, Do the Movies Have a Future?, and the difficulty of connecting underserved audiences with outstanding independent films that can't find distribution. Joining us now is Erwin Chemerinsky, who's the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and the University of Southern California, and his books include Interpreting the Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government, Federalism for the 21st Century, and his latest book is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erwin Chemerinsky.
It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
And today in the Supreme Court, in attendance was Abigail Fisher, the 22-year-old young white Texas woman who brought this case that has reached the Supreme Court that now could end affirmative action and the use of race as a factor in admitting about a quarter of the University of Texas's incoming freshmen. I noticed that retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was in the court. She wrote the majority opinion in the 2003 case that was upheld and that's now being challenged. She, of course, was replaced by Justice Samuel Alito, who's made it very clear that he's very skeptical of racial preferences. With the absence of Justice Elena Kagan, doesn't this look pretty bad for affirmative action, Erwin Chemerinsky?
Well, whether Elena Kagan was there or not, it still comes down to Anthony Kennedy. There are four justices on the current court, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito, who want to overrule that 2003 decision and want to eliminate affirmative action. If Justice Kennedy joins with them, then there's five votes to do it, whether or not Elena Kagan is present. If Justice Kennedy doesn't want to do that, then there won't be five votes, and ultimately, the court will go wherever Anthony Kennedy wants it to go.
Well, Justice Kennedy appeared quite skeptical today on Texas's the University of Texas' defense of their program, saying what you're saying is what counts is race above all.
Now, Justice Kennedy didn't ask a lot of questions today. That was the question that he asked that was most pointed, and it was put to the attorney for the University of Texas, Greg Garr. And his answer was that race is just one of many factors in admissions decisions. That's exactly what the Supreme Court in 2003 said was permissible, because the University of Texas admits three-quarters of its class through the so-called top 10% program, the top 10% of each high school get into the University of Texas. For the other 25%, it's a holistic review of the file. In fact, two different scores are calculated for each student. One is an academic index, which is their grades and test scores. The other is a personal achievement index, which is the product of two essays that are graded and seven factors. Race is one of those seven factors. So what Greg Garr said to Justice Kennedy is, race is truly just one in many factors, which is exactly what the Supreme Court prescribed 9 years ago.
So when the Chief Justice, John Roberts, Erwin Chemerinsky, says, questioning the University of Texas, asking them how the university would determine when it had a critical mass of diversity on campus that would allow it to end the program, I guess it gets down to a vision of what America looks like. And I'm curious to know why it is in the first place that this is an issue. Have the opponents of affirmative action really stated what their main problem is, apart from this idea that they are trying to frame it as reverse discrimination?
The opponents of affirmative action argue that the Constitution requires that the government be colorblind in its admissions decision. Chief Justice Rehnquist said this in an opinion in 2007 that was not coincidentally joined by Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. From their perspective, any use of race in admissions is unconstitutional.
Well, but haven't we seen America change? We used to have laws, at least children used to work in mines, women in workhouses. There's so much that's changed over the years, and arguably for the better. I just don't understand what it is that apart from this technical idea, which I suppose makes sense, that justice should be colorblind. After all, there is a blindfold over the symbol of justice. But our society is not colorblind, and it's a wounded society, and it's a society that's trying to heal those wounds. So, I just don't hear the bigger argument here. I hear technical arguments, but I don't hear the heart and soul of it.
Well, I think for them, the heart and soul is it's wrong for a white student to not be admitted to the University of Texas because of her race. It was wrong that Abigail Fisher got denied admission on this basis. Now, of course, that's not entirely accurate. The University of Texas at the trial level said that even if race hadn't been a factor at all, even if Abigail Fisher had gotten a perfect personal achievement score, she still wasn't going to get into the University of Texas. But I think what animates the conservative position, it's this notion that they believe it's wrong that one person will be admitted and another rejected on the basis of race rather than what they call merit. The problem with that argument is that no college or university has ever admitted students solely on the basis of grades or test scores. College universities have always looked to many factors in defining merit. Diversity has always been such a factor. It's always been easier to get into Harvard or Yale if a person's from North Dakota or Montana than if they're from Boston or New York City, because the college recognizes the importance of diversity. At USC, the football players get in with lower grades and test scores because they offer something else in the way of merit. And diversity is part of the merit. Diversity really matters in the classroom.
So if it's wrong for a white student to be not admitted at the University of Texas, is it right that we, for the longest time, up until only the last few decades, that almost everybody in universities in the United States were white?
Well, and to speak of the University of Texas, the University of Texas is a system that historically refused to accept African Americans. In fact, it wasn't until 1950 that the Supreme Court ordered that the University of Texas Law School admit African Americans. The reality is that because of the history of discrimination and current inequalities in the educational system, purely race-blind admissions will lead to a tremendous underrepresentation and often the absence of African American and Latino students.
Well, we've seen this this battle fought here in the University of California, and Erwin Chemerinsky, because you're the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, and one of the regents of the UC system, apparently he's an African American, but he seems to have a personal obsession about this whole issue of getting rid of affirmative action. How has it affected the undermining of affirmative action in the state of in the University of California? Has it changed? Have you noticed the change in terms?
Absolutely. In 1996, California voters adopted Proposition 209. It amended the California Constitution to say that state and local governments in California, in education, contracting, and employment, cannot discriminate or give preference on the basis of race. There was then, at all of the University of California schools, a dramatic decrease in the presence of African American and Latino students. It's come back some as colleges and universities have found ways of coping with this, but there's no doubt that it has had a significant effect in decreasing diversity. And if the Supreme Court in Fisher holds that affirmative action is unconstitutional, we will see exactly that. Let me give you a statistic to make this concrete. In the United States, in 2011, of law students who were admitted, there were only 47 African-American students in the country with an LSAT above 165 and grade point above 3.5. Now, when you look at schools like USC or UCLA or us, you're talking about schools with LSAT medians, you know, 168, 169, grade point medians of above 3.6. If you're talking about schools like Yale and Harvard and Chicago, you're talking about LSAT medians over 170, grade point averages, you know, over 3.8 as a median. Well, think about what that means in terms of the number of African Americans in law school, unless there can be some form of affirmative action.
So surely then somebody should argue to these conservative justices on the Supreme Court the very example of California, what's happened when you take it away.
And the American Bar Association and a friend of the court brief did make many of those arguments. Other of the briefs made that to the Supreme Court. But ultimately, I think it comes down to how much does Justice Kennedy believe that affirmative action should be allowed as a way of gaining diversity? It is an instance where it really comes down to one man on the Supreme Court.
Well, but that's becoming kind of a broken record, isn't it? He's the guy that everybody says. It's almost a one-man court.
At least the health care case came down to John Roberts more than Nancy Kennedy. But yeah. You're right. I mean, most issues on this court, you have a conservative block of Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, a liberal block of Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, not in this case, Kagan. And that leaves Kennedy as the swing justice. Kennedy sides with the conservatives when the court's ideologically divided, but 70% of the time, and with the liberals about 30% of the time. And all the lawyers in this case know that the future of affirmative action hinges on Anthony Kennedy. And a key thing that I think is important for your listeners to know, since Anthony Kennedy came on the Supreme Court in 1987, he has never voted to uphold any affirmative action program in any context. Not schools, not jobs, not contracts. And he's the hope of affirmative action right now.
And just in closing, if Mitt Romney's elected president, he's likely to have the opportunity to perhaps replace Justice Ginsburg, who's the most elderly member of the court, I believe. That would be a completely different court forever, wouldn't it? I mean, there wouldn't be a swing vote. There'd be a solid majority, a conservative majority.
Absolutely. Justice Ginsburg is 79. She'll be 80 in March of next year. She is the oldest of the justices. If Mitt Romney could replace her, it would surely be with another justice like Roberts or Alito. And then there would be five solid conservative votes. And then no longer would Kennedy be the swing justice.
Well, Owen Chemerinsky, we've given our audience something to think about. And I thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime. It's always a pleasure.
Likewise. Again, I've been speaking with Owen Chemerinsky, who's the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and the University of Southern California. His books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government Federalism for the 21st Century, and his latest book is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the managers of a deadly product that's caused the outbreak of meningitis, killing 12 people, escaped oversight. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Michael Carome, who is the Deputy Director of Public Citizens Health Research Group and an internationally recognized expert on the protection of human research subjects. He is also the Associate Director for Regulatory Affairs at the Office of Human Research Protections within the Department of Health and Human Services. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Michael Carome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And this outbreak of fungal meningitis from steroid injections that have been prepared by a compounding pharmacy in New England, the compounding center in Framingham, Massachusetts, or the New England compounding center in Framingham, Massachusetts, has taken its death toll has risen to 12 now. There are at least 119 infections in 10 states, and as many as 13,000 people have been exposed. Let's begin with something that's come to the table now as a result of this public health catastrophe, and that is that there's apparently there's a group of people called compounding pharmacies, and there are also, of course, drug manufacturers. And it turns out that compounding pharmacies are not regulated, even though they appear to be engaged in drug manufacturing, whereas drug manufacturers are. So walk us through the differences between these two, compounding pharmacies and drug manufacturers.
Sure. Compounding pharmacies have really been around for years. In fact, they date back a couple of centuries and were the typical pathway for someone to get a drug to treat a condition. But as we entered the 20th century, laws were passed by Congress that tightened the regulation of drugs and the role or the niche that compound pharmacies fill is really is supposed to be quite narrow now. And if you have an individual patient who has an unmet need for a medical problem and that can't be solved by a marketed drug, a compound pharmacy can produce something that can treat that individual patient under the prescription of a doctor. And for instance, if there's a patient who needs heart medicine and there is such heart medicine on the market, but they're allergic to one of the components, a compounding pharmacy can make that in a way that doesn't have that component that causes allergies. And these are, again, supposed to be tailored to individual patients. And what's happened, and then we have large drug companies that manufacture millions of doses of various drugs. Those drug companies are subject to FDA regulations. That is, they need approval from the FDA in order to market a drug, and they have to prove that their drug is safe and effective. And then once they have that approval to market a drug, they have to comply with what are called good manufacturing practices. They have to make the drug in a safe way without contaminants, particularly bacterial or fungal contaminants, when you're talking about drugs that are supposed to be sterile and are to be injected in people. Now, compounding pharmacies are not subject to those same FDA regulatory requirements, and so there's this double standard. And the recent outbreak of fungal meningitis highlights the failure of the FDA's regulatory oversight of drugs prepared by these compounding pharmacies. The problem is that some of these pharmacies have evolved from that narrow role of being a compound pharmacy to produce individual drugs for individual patients to producing drugs on a very large scale. So large-scale production of standardized versions of a drug, in the case of this meningitis outbreak, a drug that's supposed to be sterile and inject in the patients. And so they've crossed the line from the narrow role that compounding pharmacies are allowed to fill into one of drug manufacturing. But unfortunately, they haven't been following the guidelines, the regulations, the requirements that would apply to a drug manufacturer. And so we have this public health catastrophe.
And apparently the company, the New England Compounding Center in Framingham, Massachusetts, is owned by a Gregory Conigliaro, who invented a way to turn plastic into pothole filler. And he, along with his brother-in-law, Barry Cadden, who's a pharmacist, he's in charge of the New England Compounding Center, apparently the brother-in-law. But they also are owners of another company called Ameridos LLC, a private company that mixes drugs for hospitals nationwide. So both of these entities owned by these brother-in-laws are not subject to any regulation. How did they get, were they able to cross the line?
Well, I think it's important for your listeners to understand that these companies, these compounding pharmacies, started engaging in large-scale drug production and distribution across state lines, so interstate commerce. And they actually are subject to current laws that the FDA enforces, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And indeed, in 2006, the New England Compounding Center and four other compounding pharmacies simultaneously were issued warning letters by the FDA because they were engaged in practices just like we're seeing with this injectable steroid that has led to the life-threatening fungal meningitis outbreak. And the FDA said, in that case, the drugs were topical pain relievers, numbing medicines, and they were, the FDA said, you're manufacturing drugs, you're doing it in a way that's sort of mass producing, and you're distributing them across in interstate commerce, and that's illegal. You must stop doing that, and if you don't stop, we're going to seize these illegal products. And so the FDA was telling these companies that they had authority to regulate what they were doing, and they weren't complying. And what's happened is, since that time, the FDA apparently has dropped the ball. They have failed to follow up. You know, there was this great red flag back in 2006, and the same the company did the exact same thing that they were told was illegal in 2006, and so we have this public health disaster. And so there's a the FDA is culpable, you know, for the failings that have occurred here.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Carome, who's the Deputy Director of Public Citizens Health Research Group and an internationally recognized expert on the protection of human research subjects. Well, you can add to that the FDA's warning to the New England Compounding Center prior to the 2006 warning. In 2004, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the Massachusetts Board of Pharmacy inspected the New England Compounding Center and issued a warning letter taking them to task for opening sterile products and repackaging them in a way that was dangerous. And they were particularly concerned about the New England Compounding Center's splitting of a cancer drug, Avastin, into multiple doses used to treat an eye condition. So again, what's going on here? This is not just repackaging, it's repurposing.
Sure, exactly. And you are correct. So the inspection that you reference is the inspection that actually led to the warning letter that wasn't issued until almost 2 years after the inspection was completed, which in itself is surprising. It took so long to get the warning letter out. And indeed, that warning letter also cited a total of four drugs, including the repackaging of this drug Avastin that was approved for certain cancers. And the way the drug was legally prepared by the drug company that made it in the first place was in vials without any type of preservative. And because of that, you're not supposed to take it and break it up into multiple doses for subsequent use, which is what the New England Compounding Center did. And that was a violation of the label for the drug and represented, again, essentially a further drug manufacturing activity by the New England Compounding Center. And that the FDA said, that's illegal. We have authority over you. You can't do that, and you must stop. And if you don't stop, we're going to seize those illegal products. And it really is, this was a forewarning to what could happen. It's occurred essentially in the situation with the steroid injectables that they've been selling in the tens of thousands of doses across the country.
And the point being that this compounding center doesn't have the same rigorous manufacturing conditions to produce sterile drugs. The fact that they can open and break sterile labels and then repackage stuff in a non-sterile environment is just mind-boggling.
Yes, because they're functioning behind the guise of a compounding pharmacy rather than a drug manufacturer, they're not bound. They don't follow what are called good manufacturing practices that a standard drug company manufacturer would follow. And among the requirements that good manufacturing requires is producing it in a way that they are sterile, and then actually testing every lot to make sure there are no germs, no bacteria, no fungus, no viruses in the medicines. And if you find even one of those in one small sample of a particular lot, that whole lot has to be disposed of before, and so it never gets to patients. Those type of practices just aren't being done by the compounding pharmacy in this case. They should be done, again, because they are functioning in this case as a basically a large-scale manufacturer of drugs. So they should have been doing that, but they didn't. And the FDA really looked the other way and allowed this to happen.
So we don't know how many of these 13,000 people have been exposed. What's your sense of, with 12 deaths so far and at least 119 infections in 10 states, the Center for Disease Control seems to be taking the lead in this. I guess they're tracking the steroid, this injectable steroid that's been distributed. What's your sense of how much worse this can get?
Well, clearly, so far, the numbers have steadily increased day by day. The CDC is posting the daily counts of number of infections detected and the number of deaths and the number of states in which these are occurring. It actually was up to 137 today and 12 deaths. And there's been no sign that that number has peaked yet. And the FDA, the CDC, I believe, said yesterday that it may take up to 6 weeks, if not more, between an injection and being certain that a patient isn't going to get sick. So this is going to play out over the next several weeks. I don't think there's an expectation that 13,000 people are going to come down with this infection, but it certainly may reach into the several hundreds at the rate it's going, and there may be a significant number of additional deaths, unfortunately. And the great tragedy here for the families of those who have been sickened or killed by this tainted drug is that this situation was really completely avoidable. Had the FDA stayed on top of this, following their prior warning letter, had they closely monitored this company, reinspected it, these activities would have been easily detected and could have been stopped sooner.
But isn't the FDA a victim of this anti-government mania, particularly on the part of the Republicans who are obsessed with deficits and arguing the need for austerity? And it seems whenever they make cuts to government agencies, to big government, as it's called, they usually go after the regulatory staff. They've done that to the SEC. I'm assuming here they've also done the same as at the FDA. Am I correct in that, my suspicion?
I think, you know, over the last several years, the total amount of staffing at the FDA has actually increased because of the increasing use of user fees that must be paid by drug companies and to an increasing extent by medical device companies. And the fees, though, primarily go to funding the reviews of new drugs and new devices as opposed to monitoring after approval and monitoring the production and manufacturing. I mean, to some extent, some of that may be paid for, but the vast majority of those fees goes towards review activities so that the companies can be kept happy, so that they get fast reviews of their products so they can bring them to market. The part of the budget that's provided by tax dollars and appropriated by Congress has become a smaller and smaller percentage of the overall budget, and so those activities unrelated to review of drugs and devices probably are decreasing, and so they are stretched thin in terms of perhaps inspecting factories and manufacturers, and in this case, compounding pharmacies.
So just to get this straight, Dr. Michael Karam, the FDA takes private money from drug manufacturers to have their products tested and fast-tracked into the retail market, and that takes up most of the manpower. And the kind of work that's lacking in the case that we're talking about that's led to this outbreak of fungal meningitis, that's a totally separate entity, and presumably that's understaffed. It certainly doesn't seem to have the priority that the other group do.
Right. We're talking about enforcement and compliance staffing as opposed to the staff that reviews applications for approval of new drugs and new devices.
So what do you think is likely to happen now? I mean, first of all, if you're a family of the victims, you've got to be incredibly angry. and we are in a very live in a very litigious society, who do they sue? I mean, it's obviously going to be lawsuits of flying thick and fast, right?
I think that's likely to be the case as people seek to hold various parties responsible and accountable. First of all, you have the company that made the contaminated products. It's likely that they may go out of business and become bankrupt, and also likely to be held responsible or and possibly sued are physicians and clinics and hospitals that bought these drugs from compounding pharmacies and used them, perhaps knowing that they were coming from a compounding pharmacy and perhaps not in some cases, and not realizing that these compounding pharmacy drugs did not meet FDA standards. The drugs were not approved by the FDA and had not been manufactured according to the highly stringent requirements for a typical drug company, a drug manufacturer. And so I think some responsibility obviously is going to lie with the clinicians, the hospitals, and the clinics.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Makkakaram, is anybody talking about plugging this loophole?
I think we have called on Congress to investigate this tragic situation and hopefully hold aggressive oversight hearings, bringing FDA officials to the table to answer questions. And if the current statutes and regulations are found to provide the FDA with the authority to have prevented this disaster, then senior FDA officials should be held accountable. If indeed Congress finds that there are holes in the agency's existing legal authority, then Congress should act to immediately pass legislation to remedy the situation so this doesn't happen again.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Makkakaram.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Makkakaram, who's the Deputy Director of Public Citizens Health Research Group and an internationally recognized expert on the protection of human research subjects. He was also the Associate Director for Regulatory Affairs at the Office of Human Research Protections within the Department of Health and Human Services. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with the film critic for The New Yorker, David Denby, talking about his new book, Do the Movies Have a Future?
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of years without price. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Denby, who's been a staff writer and film critic at The New Yorker since 1998. Before joining The New Yorker, he was the film critic for The New York Magazine for 20 years, and his writing also has appeared in The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Review of Books, and The New Republic. And in 1991, he received the National Magazine Award for his articles on high-end audio. His books include Awake in the Dark, an Anthology of Film Criticism, 1915 to the Present, American Sucker, and his latest book just out is Do the Movies Have a Future? Welcome to Background Briefing, David Denby.
Glad to be here.
And I normally cover national security and international relations, but yet I'm across the street from Universal Studios, speaking to you from our studio here in Los Angeles, and we are, of course, in a company town here. But in terms of just going back to national security and the Cold War, it's often been suggested that in many ways the Cold War ended not because of the number of nuclear weapons pointed at each other, but because of the United States' cultural hegemony, its soft power, as it's often referred to. And the movies have played a great part in that. If this is the case, how are we doing today in terms of our soft power, in terms of our movies being our ambassador around the world?
Well, the big movies, the major studio super budget pop spectacle movies, are made more and more for the world and less for America. Two-thirds of the box office comes from overseas, which has the effect of defoliating these movies of any particular American flavor, local circumstances, complicated dialogue, psychology, and so on, which was very much part of our movies in the 70s. So our movies as cultural products are certainly playing all over the world more than ever. But they're not much about America. They, I mean, the digital stuff is sort of set everywhere and nowhere, and a lot of it is set in sort of the dead air of digital space where exacerbated pixels fight each other, and none of it really means very much. So certainly, it's a major American export, but whether people are getting the sense of the United States from these pictures, I doubt it.
So the notion is often expressed here in town with, if you go to any Starbucks, half the tables are taken up by wannabe screenwriters. So there's a lot of people out there in this town and in this business taking a crack at it. And the complaint one always hears is, well, they're not interested in movies about real things. They're only interested in making movies for 14-year-old boys. So is this to say then not only are we making films for 14-year-old boys, but we're making it sort of for a global homogenized version of the 14-year-old boy?
Yeah, 14 and up. Right. The they in that sentence means the big studios. I mean, the independent companies, some of them fairly large-sized, do make movies about real people and real things, but then you're not working at, large budget level. And I think a lot of writers have got to accustom themselves to that or have migrated to television if they want to do here and now real world stuff, because the subscription model at the cable networks, like HBO, support that stuff. Mom and dad pay the bills for a monthly subscription, right? So David Simon, the creator of The Wire and Treme, came up to me and grabbed me by the lapels once and said, as long as I don't have to sell tickets, I'll be okay. By which he meant, the HBO model that I write for works much better to do my kind of content than the movies that you're covering a lot of the time. I mean, the problem is that the blockbuster mentality has combined with the opening weekend bragging rights mentality. So a lot of movies are pitched to bring out the young audience that actually goes on opening weekend. I mean, people over 35, 40 tend to hold back until they've heard from their friends, or maybe they even follow a critic. Who knows? So if you're following, if this makes sense, people 15 to 25 exercise an influence on what gets made way out of proportion to their numbers in the population, even in the movie-going population. And grown-ups are essentially sort of treated like downsized workers the rest of the year, left to wander about aimlessly. I mean, it's not that there's nothing for them, but there's, not a lot until this magical moment at the end of September when the audience IQ rises 40 points and suddenly all the serious movies come out and, we have this 12-week season before the awards, and it happens this way every year. It's nuts. They're not cultivating grown-ups as an audience down the line. They're trying to capture 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 and 11-year-old kids with franchise entertainment based on comic books and digital spectacle, and games and young adult novels, and then hold them forever with repeats. In other words, they've tied their future to the birth rate rather than creating movies for the entire audience. I think it's a terrible mistake. I even think it's a financial mistake. But that's the way it's been going ever since the conglomerates took over the big studios, and it just gets a little worse each year.
So is there a connection here then to the demise of family-owned newspapers and the newspaper business? The New York Times, of course, is held to a high standard. The LA Times used to be a family-owned business. It was a good newspaper. And then when it got corporatized and then the corporate raider came in, completely destroyed it. Is that the case that in the old days, in the golden age of Hollywood, they were individuals that ran the studios, they were family-owned companies? Now they're big corporations, and groups of vice presidents sit around these big tables and make decisions about greenlighting movies. And I imagine in a corporate culture, it's easy to greenlight a movie that has a lot of expensive pyrotechnics and wizardry in terms of special effects, because that's a kind of bottom line that you could see. You know, you spend $1 million on an explosion, you get $1 million worth of an explosion. Finding the values in terms of characters and nuance is a whole different thing.
Yeah, it's harder to sell to a people who have to face quarterly, you know, reports to the stock analysts who want to, you know what the revenue flow is going to be. It's not as if they weren't interested in money 60 or 70 years ago. It's always been a big money game. It would be naive to think anything else. But, of course, they had less competition. There was nothing except newspapers and radio and bowling and fornication, I guess. There was not as much to do at night. Now, as everyone knows, the culture has disintegrated into a million different places. But as I say, that they've chosen to put themselves in this box by making a certain kind of movie and schooling the audience to expect a certain kind of movie. And I think they're cutting off their future audiences instead of they're catching kids at an early age with franchises and trying to hold them for 15 years. Movies were basically made for grown-ups until about 1975, 1980. I mean, they were family movies, of course, and Disney and animation and so on. But if you were a kid in the 50s and 60s, you got dragged by your parents and you half understood what was going on and you half didn't understand. And that was sort of laid the groundwork for grown-up taste in movies. You weren't expected to remain in a state of goofy euphoria forever. So it's in a way self-destructive, as well as destructive of, I think, the culture of movies and the language of movies. So many of these big movies, the way action is staged, you just don't remember a thing the next day. That nothing imprints itself except the busyness of digits contending in dead space. And so you wake up the next day and you have nothing in your head. That isn't good either.
But isn't that easier, in terms of creativity? That's an easy, lazy shot to fire a gun, have a gunfight or a car chase. It's so much more difficult to explore the violence in the human heart. I mean, isn't that?
Well, absolutely. And maybe people will feel something. All of that's being pushed to the margins, to independent films, to this sort of Holocaust and tears and dysfunctional family season that that we're in now. Actually, it's a little more public-spirited this year than usual. There's Argo, Ben Affleck's film about the hostage crisis. There's Lincoln, and so on. But normally, it's intense family dramas or things like The Fighter. What you're talking about is held to this particular period, or it's migrated to television, and they've sort of given up on a lot of the older audience and let them go, which I think is a shame. I think they've broken the contract, the unspoken contract with the public, which the movie companies always felt they had to render something of the country's soul, something of its social relations, something of its streets, its parks, its interiors, that they've just given that up. Look, the old guys were Philistines in many ways. But they felt an obligation to bring what they thought was the best to the public. I mean, they were immigrants. They wanted to assimilate. They wanted respectability. They wanted to get into the country clubs and all of that. And they felt they had to bring the best to a large audience, that was their way in. The guys now just don't have, they're college educated and business school educated, and they have none of that sense of obligation. This book, by the way, is not all lamentation. There's a lot of it that's celebratory about what's good, and there's stuff on genres and like chick flicks and high school movies, and there's pieces about movie acting and so on. It's not, I don't want to seem like Dr. No here, and also I jump at any signs of life in the commercial movie culture, whatever it is, whether it's Ridley Scott's craftsmanship in Prometheus or Richard Gere giving a good performance in Arbitrage or Ben Affleck's thriller, as I mentioned before, Argo. Wherever there's life, critics have to go. I mean, and not be snobby about wherever it is. You go for it. And I'm particularly happy about, you know, pushing a small independent film like Beasts of the Southern Wild, because I think it's really magnificent. But if there's something good in a $150 million movie, I'm not going to turn my back on it.
Right. So you're not a liberal elitist.
Of course I'm a liberal elitist.
So are we talking about then the corporatization of our culture, and in this case multinational corporations sending this ubiquitous product around the world and blanketing the world in these quick hits that they do globally because of the problem with piracy? Now, Hannah Arendt once said that the rule by corporations is the rule by nobody, and it seems in many ways that we are in a kind of corporate plutocracy, if you will. Some people think our democracy is threatened by an emerging oligarchy. But is this to do then with the corporatization of our culture?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's happened. It's happened in music. It's happened in many other places. Oh, there's always stuff that, you know, just as in music, you've got all kinds of renegade bands. And so now you can make movies very cheaply and sell them through the internet. I mean, it's not as if this is the only movies coming out, and they're small and medium-sized independent companies, although some of them have a lot of trouble getting their films into the theaters. Gaining traction in the theaters can be very, very hard. It's very expensive. Publicity is very expensive. Here's the killer. The theater chains don't necessarily want something like Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is an extraordinary movie that came out and cost exactly $1.3 million, came out last summer, and is at the moment the leading contender for the Oscar, unless Lincoln, you know, Spielberg's movie knocks it out of that spot. But anyway, they don't necessarily want an independent movie, because the whole theater business in the complex is about getting the maximum number of people to the concession stands. The ticket price cleans the toilet, keeps the lights on, keeps the projectors running. The money is made at the concession stand. So you're not going to give a shot to a movie which may do less well at a screen than Batman. You might add Batman to two screens, or three, or four, or five, however many it can bear. So it's about volume of bodies. So, I mean, it's very rough. It's not that interesting movies aren't being made independently. They are. And if I can be self-important for a moment, the critics are often the ones standing between those movies and oblivion, because many of them do open and disappear. I mean, the New York Times reviews about 10 of them every Friday, and most of them don't get very far. So it's not a business model that's working very well, all in all. Now, the studios are putting so much money into these enormous films that if one of them really flops, the studio boss has to quit. That's not a sane business model, is it? This happened with John Carter earlier this year. And there are two ways out of this box, I think, that they've put themselves into. One is to make a slate of small winners. In other words, spend much less, go for a much smaller take. For instance, End of Watch, the cop movie that's out right now, which is quite good, with Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena, was made for exactly $7 million, which by Hollywood standards is peanuts, and it's going to gross about 50 domestically and maybe the same overseas, and then all the ancillary markets will kick in. You could make 7 or 8 of those if you were a studio each year. They might not all be that good, but you could try. That's one way. The other way, which Steven Soderbergh, the writer-director, has been pushing for years, is to cut way down on upfront costs. In other words, don't pay stars $10 million or $12 million. Pay them what is a reasonable amount, I mean a moderate amount, rather, by Hollywood standards, like $1 million, and pay the director $750,000 and so on. And then divide everything by fixed percentages at the back end as all the revenue comes in perpetuity. Continue dividing it. And obviously the financing people would get the most, since they put up the money, but the star would get his 3% forever, and the director would get his 2% forever, and so on. And by bringing down initial costs by 30 or 40%, Soderbergh believed, the studio boss could make more interesting choices. He wouldn't be so quite so dominated by the marketing people. You know, he might, for heaven's sakes, actually put his own taste into operation. So, I mean, there are ways out of this box. They just don't want to do it.
Again, I'm speaking with David Denby, a film critic at The New Yorker, and his new book just out is Do the Movies Have a Future? So just in terms of going back to the idea of the U.S. being the kind of global cultural hegemon, what do you think is this perennial, now that we're in a political season? The Republicans have a particular dislike for Hollywood. It's a pejorative, and I'm curious to know why it is that in terms of politics, it seems that the talent is on the left, or at least supporting, not that the Democrats are that far on the left, but they tend to support the Democrats, whereas the conservatives are the ones that are railing against Hollywood. I mean, you know, the woman that's going to be not debated tomorrow night in the vice presidential debate, but apparently Ayn Rand had an influence over the vice presidential nominee on the Republican side, Paul Ryan.
Sure.
She was a basically a bitter failed Hollywood screenwriter, wasn't she?
Who yes, helped start a philosophical novelist.
Right, but she's helped. Yes. She helped gin up the House of Un-American Activities, which is still an open wound here in this town.
Well, Hollywood has generally been liberal, in part because it's a popular medium, and you know, what was the people's medium, the art form. For everyone, so there were a lot of populist-themed movies in the 30s and anti-fascist movies in the 40s, particularly from Warner Brothers. And I mean, it's not that there weren't right-wing figures like John Wayne and, to some degree, James Stewart, although they made all kinds of movies. But it's generally been a liberal community just by the nature of the business and who and how large an audience they have to appeal to. So I don't think there's anything surprising about that. It's almost functional in a way. I think the Republican attitude towards Hollywood is a non-starter. It's stupid, and I mean, they should stop it.
Well, but there's no symmetry between the kind of money that a few celebrities give and the kind of money that under Citizens United that a big corporation can
give. Absolutely not. Right. No, the big corporations, we are becoming a plutocracy in this election. And there are right-wing plutocrats who are putting money to make political movies. This film, which was a complete flop, won't step back, won't stand back, whatever it was called.
Oh, about
won't
the teachers.
Back down.
Yeah, yeah.
About the parent trigger law, those parents and teachers taking over a school. It's an anti-union movie. Just was put up, the money for that was put up by Philip Anschutz, who also made Waiting for Superman. Which was a very misleading documentary about how great charter schools and how dreadful the public school system is. So Anschutz is, you know, putting his money into movies that push a right-wing agenda.
Well, didn't that film that was out recently by Dinesh D'Souza, which was a hit job against Obama,
that did well. That was a big hit.
That did well, didn't it?
Yes, it was I didn't see it, but it did very well for a documentary, well over $20 million. And I've met Dinesh D'Souza, and I would describe him as unreliable in his views.
Well, that's a very polite way of putting it.
Polite as I can be.
Again, I'm speaking with David Denby, who's the film critic for The New Yorker. He's the author of the new book just out, Do the Movies Have a Future? So just to stay with documentaries for a minute, my sense is that the reason we're seeing so many documentaries is that the news business, which has been corporatized, I mentioned that before about the family ownership of the New York Times vis-a-vis the corporate takeover of the LA Times and its subsequent demise, I suspect that a lot of the reason why we have so many politically themed feature documentaries out is that the big news organizations are closing down their investigative bureaus because they're too expensive and all they do is invite lawsuits, and the legal department basically hates the investigative department.
Yeah.
And so is that what's going on here?
I think you're right. I think let me be low-minded also that documentaries have become much cheaper to make since the invention of digital technology, because when I was a film student 45 years ago, I mean, if you were going to make anything except a film about the local sewerage problems, you had to get the money from your parents, and it was a lot of money to make even a half an hour film. So if you can just get out there, you know, in the streets or do your investigative reporting with a lightweight digital camera, not print anything, and edit on a computer, it brings the costs way down. This should be a great period for documentary. It's, you know, this is a politically exciting time and a dangerous time. I mean, and there have been, I liked Inside Job, Charles Ferguson's movie very much. I like him more than Michael Moore, whose shtick I think I've gotten tired of about three movies ago. So, and then there are veterans like Frederick Wiseman who have been doing them for years, who were very good. I think, and a lot of it's made for public television. And it plays at film festivals, which, by the way, film festivals in every city, which I used to make fun of, have become a transmission point for a lot of interesting movies, foreign films, documentaries, and independent American movies, because people can't see them at the mall. So they have to go to these film festivals, and they are happy to go to them. It's one of the things that's keeping the independent cinema going, is this, you know, a film city in every town in the country, virtually.
Well, David Denby, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new book, Do the Movies Have a Future?
Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with David Denby. He's been a staff writer and film critic at The New Yorker since 1998. Before joining The New Yorker, he was a film critic for The New York Magazine for 20 years. His writings also appeared in The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Review of Books, and The New Republic. And in 1991, he received the National Magazine Award for his articles on high-end audio. His books include Awake in the Dark, an anthology of film criticism, 1915 to the present, and American Sucker. And his latest book just out is Do the Movies Have a Future? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manas and Tariq Mohammed. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.